My name is Shelley Alcorn, and I'm just going to give you a few housekeeping notes before we kick off the presentation. You've heard it before, but I'm going to say it again. Please silence cell phones and electronic devices. The session is being streamed and recorded. We have a live audience online going to 400 different locations in the United States and internationally, so we're very happy to have them with us as well as you. Because of that, it's very important that when we have questions and answer periods or when there's audience input, that the people in the room use the standing mics, one in the middle of the front part and one near the back, so that the online audience can hear your question, so they feel involved. The last thing, we have session evaluations that are very important for you to complete. You can complete them on site, or you can have a little time to reflect and complete them over the next couple of days. But you can find those online session evaluations on the session details page within the online website agenda, the mobile app, and for those virtual viewers, you can find it in the virtual conference center on the session page. And now I'm going to kick it to Jude, who's going to introduce himself and the rest of the panel, and we're going to start talking about social presence. Thanks.
Right. Am I live? All right. Sounds like I'm live. So just as a reminder for those who may have come in a bit late, there's a link at the bottom of the page here, link.mnsu.edu/educ13. It looks like I haven't gotten any feedback that you can't get to that page. It's just a little Google Doc page that has some resources, both related to what we're going to talk about right here today, but also some reference materials for later. And one thing that we'll do, I'll show you Chime in Cloud in a bit, and that is it's both an open source installable, but also just a cloud-based service audience response system. And we'll use that a bit today. If there's anything that comes in through the back channel on Chime in Cloud, the instructions are at that page for how to add responses that we don't get to in the Q&A, we will respond to every question in that same page at the bottom of the page. So it'll just be a way for us to continue to dialogue past our session today. So I want to get you started here. On that page that I just mentioned, and I'll show it to you here very quickly, there are two questions that are already open there in Chime in Cloud. If you want to answer on the web, you can just click the link. So the first one I want to ask is, what are some features of digital or social presence? You can see that right here. You can answer there, or if you prefer, you can text in your response by typing 114 plus your answer to the number that you see on that page. This works for our remote audience as well as the folks who are right here. The second question that we've got there is just general questions, anything you've got. Now, I realize the folks at home have a back channel. That's also an appropriate way to ask questions, so feel free to do that. But if you go to that page, we'll be able to see your questions, and if we don't get to them, we'll be able to follow up a bit after the session and post it. Okay, so as you're answering our question there, I'll tell you a little bit about what we've got going on today. So we're going to have a quick introduction and overview. That's where we're at now. We're going to talk a little bit about this idea of social presence and why we think you should care, or why at least we care, and what motivates this. And then we'll talk a little bit about some experiments that we're doing at Minnesota State Mankato that we think map to the principles of social presence as we're going to lay them out. Then I'm going to punt it over to my colleague Matt Clay, and he's going to talk a little bit about how we're trying to create that culture of innovation and use that idea of social presence and that theoretical orientation as a kind of a guiding star as we, you know, look at all the things we've seen over the last 2 days and more. You know, how do you sort of have a compass? How do you have a framework that helps you drive and keeps you from just being a tinkerer, but actually sort of drives thoughtful innovation? And then we'll have some questions. So, quick introductions. Myself, I'm Jude Higdon. I'm the assistant CIO for Academic Technology Services at Minnesota State Mankato. And I am an avid yogi. So if you want to practice at the back of the room after class, I'll be ready for it, or after this session, and I'll get everyone into a forearm balance, I promise. I can do that. Maybe I can do that. My colleague Matt Clay here is the Assistant CIO for Consulting and Technology Services. He serves as the liaison between my team, which is the Central Academic Technology Unit, and all of the colleges on campus. So we really are kind of hub and spokes model where we're at, and that works very well. We're also joined by our colleague Brian Schneider, not pictured, strategically not pictured, and Brian is our tech nerd. He is the assistant CIO for technology services. He keeps the pipes running. So he's here if you have any technical questions about what we're going to talk about. All right, so quickly, let's see what you said in Chime-In. All right, so what Chime-In Cloud does, and this is freely available at chimeincloud.com, you can use it yourself if you like. For these open-ended questions, you get a little Twitter-like feed here at the bottom, and then we get a sort of aggregated word cloud here that tells us. So when we talk about social presence, you know, we can see some themes emerging here. Students, connected, access, ability, communication. These are some of the big themes that you all brought up as you started talking about what you, sort of your visceral instincts, or maybe some of you are familiar with this theoretical paradigm that it gets to. And obviously we have presence, digital presence, interests, delivery, think. So some really interesting themes starting to emerge here. And I think your instincts here are really spot on. I think we'll start to get to more of those as we or some of those themes as we talk here. So what is this idea of social presence? Why are we talking about it? The way we think about it is situated within a theoretical construct of the community of inquiry model. So this is sort of by good Dr. Garrison. The bibliography is at the end of this session, so if you want to check our work, we always encourage that. But the basic idea is that one model for thinking about constructive learning ecosystems is that you've got these different types of presence. You've got your teaching presence, and that tends to be where we focus often, right? We've got content to cover, I've got stuff I need to teach, I'm gonna run, right? And I've gotta teach this. But really to have a balanced learning ecosystem, we have to have cognitive presence, we have to have students thinking hard about the material, right? You can, if it's all teaching presence, you could be teaching a wall. You could be teaching a sleeping student. You could be teaching a student who's not thinking hard about what it is that you're working with, right? And then there's social presence. And the social presence component of this really has to do with, frankly, an epistemological belief about how people learn. It really says learning does not only happen here. Learning actually happens in the space between us. We create knowledge together through interaction. And so as we start to think about blended and online learning, that social presence element, really, if we believe that we learn when we interact together, that component of it, technology has to enhance that. It can't diminish it. It can't make us feel separated from other learners and from instructors. It has to make us feel more connected. It has to make us feel more present and bring us together so that we hit this sweet spot in the middle where the students are thinking hard, we're teaching hard, and we have robust social interactions to help us create learning. A very, very functional definition comes from Bjelke Harmsenbergen. It's just a sense of being with another person. You want to feel like you're learning from a person and with a person, not just in isolation. Very quickly, the theoretical underpinnings here go all the way back to Leo Vygotsky. I only bring this up, I'm not going to go into social constructivism, but to say that this has a long and storied history in the learning science literature. Al Bandura, the father of social cognitive theory from Stanford, also talks about these things, and so it's I'm getting an amen up here in the front, so I think we're doing well here. So we want to sort of pivot quickly and start talking about what does it mean to think about technology-enhanced learning, blended learning, distance learning, with this idea of social presence. Whether we've made our case or not, you can check our work and decide for yourself. But let's assume that we have. What does that look like in the world? So some things that we've seen and how we've tried to pilot. In the top left here, we've got things like Google Hangouts, right? It's a very, very easy go-to meeting, whatever. Take your consumer level video conferencing appliance of choice. Anecdotally, I can tell you, I've been teaching online at the University of Minnesota for almost 4 years now. And I will say that I have not been great at feeling connected to my students. The University of Minnesota went with a Google implementation, and I started implementing, oh no, the moderator, demerits in the front. I never had a real sense of connection to my students. We had the capacity to start doing a Google Hangout. I did a pilot with my online students, fully online, 2 semesters ago, where I started requiring 3 sets of office hours. They had to show up physically at their computer in a Google Hangout. It's trivial to put together if you're a Google campus. You create a calendar event, you invite them, and you click a button that says add the Hangout. It transformed that class. It completely transformed my interaction with my students. Not only was I willing to sort of see them as people in a strange way, if they had a problem in the class, I wasn't like, oh, these are just online students trying not to do work. I was like, oh, I know that guy. We talked. There was something about that. But they were actually willing to cut me more slack. When something happened technologically, they were like, they saw me as a human being. It humanized the experience, and we were able to sort of get beyond some of the administrative hurdles that had plagued that course for years. It was bizarre. I never would have thought that that kind of a present moment would sort of have that transformation, but for me it had. We're looking at ways to do a lot more presence even in asynchronous kind of lecturing environments, right? One of the biggest complaints I get from my faculty is that when they record lectures for online, the disembodied voice sitting over it, they feel very detached from their content. They're like, well, my content's just out there. Couldn't you just steal that? And, you've all heard this. You may have experienced this. I've experienced this as an instructor. One thing that we've been playing around with in this idea of with the presence lens is really trying to feature faculty when they talk about their content, to really sort of make them, their person, intimately attached. So creating a studio environment where faculty can come, record themselves physically juxtaposed with their content, and that's really in an inextricable way. And we've actually done some studies on this where students have self-reported, so take that with what it means, that the experience of seeing their instructors juxtaposed, they felt like they actually attended to the material more. It brought cognitive presence, at least from their experience, rather than sort of feeling like, oh, well, this is just this mindless slideshow droning on at me. Now, we have a custom solution for this. Panopto can do this, Echo 360 can do this. They couldn't do it a couple years ago. They're getting much better. But we believe there's something to that, really featuring faculty as opposed to disembodying them from their content. Now, the big one that we're really going all in on is the actual quote-unquote telepresence, like Cisco's telepresence. And there are other competitors in the market. I apologize to those at home, how many of you are familiar with telepresence? So we've got roughly half. Very quickly here, think of Skype, and then think of everything you hate about Skype being gone, and make it perfect, right? It's like Skype on steroids. Telepresence, it never fails. The audio is impeccable. The video is impeccable. The only thing they haven't really figured out how to pump through the system is the smell of the other room. It really is life-sized. We've had experiences where people at our telepresence rooms feel like by the end of a meeting, start to try to pass a paper through the screen because they forget that the people aren't physically present in the room. So the model is, at least with the immersive telepresence like these, it's a fishbowl, the arc, so you're on the other end. We've actually had students in a telepresence experience, the larger rooms, 18-seat rooms, we actually make it to 30, so we can do 60-student rooms, that connects the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, down with our home location in Mankato. We've had instructors teaching these courses, technically distance learning courses, from the cities to our students in Mankato. And actually, the students who are there present with the instructors in the cities complain that they're getting a lesser experience because they feel like this instructors who are create a better sense of presence across this technology, right? It really is bringing students together in a very, very unique and dynamic way that we haven't seen. It also allows the students to see each other. I mean, the instructional paradigm here is fundamentally shifted. That's a bit outside the scope of this talk, but the students are actually, the design of the space implies that the students are going to be talking to each other, that social constructivist learning together kind of model that we talked about. So some other things that we're sort of really playing around with is the idea of sort of creating presence when we're not present, when we're physically not present. And we got to some of this before, but we've really tried to start playing around with the idea of ways to scale augmented reality kinds of models. And I will tell you that we're very, very nascent in these. I've been hearing about augmented reality for years. If you're not familiar with the basic concept, the easiest cognitive organizer I can give you is think about Yelp, okay? And if you go to a new city, perhaps Anaheim, that you're not from, you can sort of take a location-aware device, right? And you can say, all right, tell me all the places to get a martini and close by. And it will sort of say, well, I know where you're physically located. Let me add a data layer on top of that and augment your physical reality to give you meaningful information. It's not all that augmented reality is, but it's a good slice of what we're talking about. So we've been working on augmented reality sort of gaming, trying to intersect the ideas of building a pedagogical narrative with letting students be in a physical space and creating presence. What does that look like? I have a colleague, Julie Sykes, who's at the University of New Mexico. And she created an augmented reality game for her Spanish class. So the students, the big problem, right, with teaching Spanish is, well, we want them using the language in authentic context. You know, like we don't want them conjugating shoe verbs. I mean, you've got to conjugate shoe verbs, but you want to do something with the language, right? You want it to be useful. You want to be sort of present in that real environment. So what she did was created an augmented reality game, gave the kids a phone, and sent them to a Spanish-speaking community in Santa Fe. And she said, you know, you're going to go around, and I'm going to drive you through with Spanish language clues. You're going to interact with people in the community to find out about that community, and you're going to have to actually use Spanish in a meaningful way in dialogue with people in the real world. Is that me? Yep. Okay. Sorry, I get a little excited. You're going to have to use it in a way and actually understand the language, be able to apply what you've learned through these dialogues with people, apply it to the game, and then it'll unlock the next place that you go. So it sort of extends the classroom and creates that ability to extend the classroom into a presence model where people can actually be out in the world in an authentic way, right? We're doing a lot of work with sort of WYSIWYG RPG gaming and some of this. And the presence lens on that is the ability to sort of allow students to work in an authentic model that has lower stakes. So some of the things we've been looking at with that is like medical gaming, where students need to be able to sort of do emergency triage or something like that. We want a sort of an authentic environment where they're collaborating together, but we can't just throw them into that. So as a way to kind of scaffold the cognitive presence and the social presence where they can work together on authentic problems that then they can sort of get their feet wet before we move them on to more authentic situations where they're in clinicals or something like that. Apps and ebooks, how are we doing on time, Matt?
You're okay for a minute.
Okay, I just don't want to steal all of Matt's time here. One of the things that we've been trying to think a lot about is not the model of ebooks where our students are entirely consumers of content through ebooks, but also where our faculty can be producers of content of ebooks. So we've started playing around with the idea of doing templates in iBooks and in a tool called Sigil, which, again, I'm not selling anything, but Sigil is, it will produce ebooks for Kindle and other things, where we can actually take the content that faculty have built into their online courses and very quickly roll that into a self-contained ebook that students can have. Now, if there's anyone from the LMS world out here, what I'd like to have is a button that does that, but for the time being, we don't have. It would be great to say, hey, I've curated this. But if you do a nice job with your instructional design, right, in your online course, and you've got modules, well, modules translate to chapters very organically. And we found that right now what we do is we've got a nice little template. We sick a student, undergrad student on it, and in the course of about a week or two, if it's a well-curated online course, we can create an ebook out of that course. again, with that presence lens, part of what we're trying to do is create a moment where students, no matter where they are, can sort of find a cognitive connection back to the course, can find whatever their sort of world and ecosystem is, that sort of didactic portion, they can offload, right? They have that in their mobile experience, and then when they're sort of back in the real world, we have more time for that social component of it. All right, so thinking about sort of some of the cognitive stuff, how many of you have heard about learning analytics? I'm just guessing maybe more than one of you this week. Okay, a couple of you have actually heard about learning analytics. We are not immune to the learning analytics craze. Part of what we have a Gates Foundation grant that is a learning analytics grant. So we're part of the Purdue, the big Purdue grant. And basically the charge of this grant is to explore and build meaningful learning analytics models. You know, they're very nascent right now. And one thing I've discovered this week as I've listened to different people talking about learning analytics is I don't think we've decided what that means yet. I think we all kind of mean a lot of different things with it. So it's probably useful to find terms a little bit here. When we looked at this, what we really decided, the essence of what we thought for our type of an institution, learning analytics should do, is it should provide instructors with more meaningful information about where students, individual students, were really struggling and what a meaningful interaction from the instructor to the student to put them on a more productive path would be. That's really the essence of our model, right? We really want an analytics package to tell this instructor something that they can't get from just looking at a grade book and to say, and this is what that student, you know, should do. We looked at a lot of the enterprise tools that were out there, things like Course Signals, some of the LMS, the vertical LMS tools we have Desire to Learn, which has strengths and limitations. But one of the things that became very clear to us very quickly in our analytics analysis was that our instructors are not living in the LMS. And most of the metaphors for learning analytics that are out there assume that all of the meaningful data about your students lives in your LMS. That's just, and we have integration, but our instructors live in a lot of worlds. They have a lot of meaningful data. They have clicker data, or they have, they're working with Cengage, or they're working with some other adaptive learning environment. And when that integration happens, all of the rich analytical data that's happening in these other ecosystems, it really gets baked out by the time it gets into the LMS. So for us, the way we defined learning analytics, those tools were fundamentally not going to work because really what we were going to get is a summative analysis of where students were at a given moment. All of the meaningful rich data and these different data marts were gone. And that didn't get us to our goal. So we rolled our own, and we'll see if it actually goes anywhere. But we call it MavClass, we're the Mavericks, Minnesota State University Mankato, the Comprehensive Learning Analytics Support System. And if it goes anywhere, we'll release it open source probably sometime next year. That's just how we roll at Minnesota State Mankato. It's part of what we believe in. The idea that we're operating under is that we want to be able to pull data from multiple data sources, create a data mart, or maybe you would think of it as a mini data warehouse, I guess, that normalizes that, and then we want to be able to provide the instructor really rich and interesting data backwards to them about both where an individual student is at that moment, but also about their teaching more broadly. So let me give you an example of what that looks like. We have started to see in our Math 98 course some really interesting correlations looking at legacy data with this tool. As we've pulled this in, we've actually identified two key concepts in this course that if students fail, they have an 80% chance failure rate in the course. There's two moments that seem to correlate incredibly highly with lack of success later in the course. And so we're like, wow, that's interesting. What are we going to do with that information? You know, and now we've got to figure out what we're going to do with that information. So we're working with the instructor to start doing some instructional design around that. We're also going to try to dig deeper into current students' practices around that. Who knows if the data from this semester will bear that out? We don't know. It's new. But to see, okay, is there, if students self-report having spent 20 minutes on this versus 2 hours on this, that we can say, hey, guess what? If you put in another hour on this concept, this really improves your chances of sort of moving forward in a meaningful way in this class. This is really key in some ways. So those are the kinds of things that we're hoping to be able to do that's a lot more directed than sort of, you're failing this class, you need to work harder. You know what I mean? Which is where I think a lot of the tools are at right now. We'll see if we can pull it off, but that's part of what we're trying to do. And again, the idea is to provide the instructor with more meaningful so that those presence moments are more meaningful. Video. Our campus historically has had no thoughtful video metaphor. We don't have a way to communicate about ourselves visually in any kind of comprehensive way. We have been in the process of creating a system called MavTube, which is basically, can you tell we put Mav in front of everything? That's like a, it's actually getting a little tired, I have to say. But MavTube is our campus version of YouTube. You might ask, why aren't you just doing this on YouTube? We do have a YouTube presence. The challenge with YouTube is that it's tough to curate because of the social media component of it. So it's hard to keep people within your ecosystem and sort of drive a lot of that. There's a link to MavTube, and the investment in thinking about it this way has really allowed some money to flow here, where as our population gets more diverse, we have more of a diaspora of students who are coming in from the cities, who never physically come to campus. We're trying to leverage that idea of really having that visual presence about campus to make people feel connected, to make people feel like a Maverick. You know, we want you to know that your football team is one of the best in Division III. You know, we want you to know that the theater program is doing amazing stuff. And when we do things that are in the public domain, we're going to stream it live to you because you're a Maverick. You know, you get the experience. Even if you can't come to the theater, we want you to experience that experience and quality. Creating that, again, sense of presence. All right. So that's some of the crazy stuff we've been doing and the lens of the social presence kind of component that we're trying to put to it. I'm going to punt it over to my colleague, Matt, now.
All right. My name is Matt Clay again, and that's a lot of really cool stuff, but how do you actually make it happen, and how do you have the conversations with the faculty to help them think about the duality of these students and their, you know, everybody has their kind of digital citizens and their physical citizens, and these two aspects of people, and they're not even equal anymore. I think that when you look at how many friends people have on Facebook, and they really truly believe that they're friends, their social online presence may even be significantly larger than their face-to-face one. So how do we actually facilitate that conversation? And that's what my team does. My team is embedded out in the colleges as technology directors. We lead their technology committee teams, co-lead with a teacher, with another faculty member. And we create these committees and we talk about things and we find leaders both within the faculty and within the students. So students participate in these conversations and start talking about, here's what our expectations are, here's what we need to do. One of the really cool things, I know it's slightly off topic, but we're creating a 1, a 5, and an 11-year grade, 1, 5, and 1, 5th, and 11th grade video that's going to talk about what your students are going to be in 1 year, in 5 years, and in 10 years to help our faculty come through this thinking process of what are the expectations. Because just sitting in a classroom face-to-face with the professor is not enough. Even in only a face-to-face classroom, there can be a whole environment of social media going on in the background between the students that are sitting right next to each other. So our job is to sit out there, work with people, and help create leaders and get faculty interested in driving. And this even means rethinking physical learning spaces. Because blended learning isn't just, you know, it's both physical and out in the. So how do you make a space that allows students to come in from the outside, erases the walls, makes things so the teacher can be successful, everything is transparent, things just work, and students can bring what they want to the table? Those are the kinds of spaces that we're trying to create now throughout the campus, where, and it's beyond technology. one of the coolest things we learned about our telepresence classrooms is students will get there early, and they don't just talk to the person sitting next to them, they talk to the people across from them, in the next town, building, in the next wherever it's at, state, globally. They actually have real conversations, and they stay after class talking across the technology system. It's really cool, but how do you do that in a space like this if students are going to log into Adobe Connect and they can only do it once the teacher gets there and makes the thing? How do we schedule that when the next class before that lasts right up until the hour, somebody is racing in, there's none of that social interaction that these students have. So we need to rethink just the whole entire, how is a classroom functional and how does it work beyond technology? And that's what we started to do. Even to large spaces like an auditorium, this is an auditorium of 140 students, but because we put a small table and a large table on same tier, when we want them to work collaboratively, we can have a 140-seat collaborative classroom. We just have the kids in the front row turn around and work with the kids in the back row. And you can actually have a collaborative classroom that the teacher walks around and gets to know their students when there's 140 of them. It's really interesting and cool how you can make things happen if you really, really take the time. Here we have tables that have that will have cameras on them this next summer, so we can have a table of five here working with a table of five up in the cities. And having this team of 10 that will have collaborative workspaces that will be able to create presentations that they can share to this class and to the other class and work really well together. So that's what we do. We talk to the faculty about how they'd want to think of their space, how they want to be innovative, what do you want to do to be successful. Let's talk about dreams. We never talk about functional budgets when we first talk to faculty. We always talk about what do you want to do? What would be the perfect thing for you to do? And in doing that, we're creating kind of this culture of innovation. And so this is a very brief overview of what I feel like is kind of our philosophy, our innovation philosophy. And part of it is our team will play with every kind of technology we can get our hands on. And by doing that, we redefine disruptive technology. We don't even call it disruptive technology because we want a positive term, and sometimes disruptive can seem negative. But it's our fundamental belief that if you don't play with every new device, all the new operating systems, all the new technologies, you start losing skills. You start putting a gap in your skills. If you wait three generations to get something new because you only have a four-year recycling phase, you lose those 3 years of intimate knowledge with whatever the new operating system or whatever the new feature is, and you have to bridge that gap. And sometimes that's really hard to do. So if you take a look at some of our IT teams, you have very focused. We have, in 10 computers they'd have, 8 PCs, 2 Macs, and a couple of iPads. You look at Jude's team and my team, we've got Chromebooks, we've got iPads, we've got Android tablets, we've got Microsoft tablets, we've got Macs, we've got PCs, and we've got Linux. All of these things.
Give me?
Yeah, we want Google
I'll take
Glass.
It. So bad. Yeah, we don't have Google Glass. But we really want it.
We're trying. If we can buy it, somebody on my team is testing it. We have Chromecast stuff out there, Apple TV stuff. You name it, we're out there doing it. And we're trying to alleviate the pressure of this disruption. If we know about it, we've played with it, we've thought it through, we can be ready when things change quickly. With that in mind, we need to have a sustainable infrastructure. When, now it's probably 3 devices our students have on us, but with this new terminology of Internet of Things, students could be walking in with 5, 10, 6, 7, 8 things that could be hitting the Internet at the same time. Do we have an infrastructure that can support that? And do we need to? Are they going to be bringing their own? I mean, how many of them have 4G, LTE, whatever, 3G? And what will it be in 5 years, in 10 years? Are we ready for what else we would need? And that's probably power. And wireless power, if we could get it, it'd be awesome. But anyway, so we develop these leaders and these partners in the colleges, and we have seen tremendous shifts in the way that faculty think. They want to be on these technology committees because they know they're going to get to try new things and they're going to get new technology, but they also know that if you sit down with one of my team, we will help you write the best grant you've ever seen when it comes to making sure that the technology and infrastructure is there to make you successful. There have been many times when a faculty member, and they can't be expected to know about technology, will write a grant but not have the real depth they need in the technology part, so there's not enough money, so something doesn't work or something doesn't happen to make that as good as it could be. We're helping to make that change. And with that in mind, when we do these grants and partnerships and we try these new innovations, we work with Jude's team really closely to create, we have a value system and frameworks that say, this is what we need to do. We believe in social presence. How can we make sure that our classrooms and our online spaces have the capabilities and the teachers have the understanding to create the content for these students to have these external languages, conversations outside of the classroom or during the classroom? And when we fail, it's okay. We will fail. What is Google saying? Fail smart, fail fast, or fail fast, fail smart, whatever it is. Same thing, but if you have a value system and a framework, then you can't get mad at somebody for trying something new. And that's one of the biggest and scariest things for some of our staff. IT people, surprisingly, don't change quickly with technology. And so our team, because of that, is kind of thought of, we challenge everything, we cause problems, but we do, and we have to do that. Because you can sit here and say, I've had no errors on the email server, or our storage system is awesome, it gives them more space than anybody else. But if it doesn't have one thing that they need, if it doesn't actually meet the requirements, they're going to go find it somewhere else. And so to keep IT relevant and to keep serving the needs and be aligned with the university, we have to start challenging things that are kind of stagnant. And then the last two things, the scheduling innovation, that's one of the things I always put time on my calendar. I call it defensive calendaring, maybe that's even a thing. But I put a time, I'm going to sit there and I'm going to think about stuff. I'm going to come up with some ideas. Once a week I come up with ideas. And then whenever I meet with my team, each one I ask, what could I get you that you would do better with your job? Some faculty member would get excited about, is there anything out there we can do? Let's talk. And then during my team meetings, half of my team meetings are brainstorm sessions where we sit down and we think up stuff. Now, half of IT thinks that all we do is come up with work for them, but it's good ideas, things that may never happen, but they're things that we need to think about. And that's just how we kind of schedule innovation into that. And because of that, it helps us in our mindset of rethinking and managing teaching expectations. Faculty have certain expectations. Technology should be easy. If I can go to Google and get an email address, and I don't need any help from the service desk to get my password or do anything, how is yours better if I need to go to all these pages and log in and activate and blah, blah, blah? And so we need to talk to them about, they don't understand security, informational security, and those kinds of things. And they do, but just not really. And so our job is to help manage their expectations, manage the time that they have for these projects. You can't just put up a server and make something work in a week. We all wish that was the case. And if people were dedicated, maybe we could. But thinking about the innovations, working with the faculty, sitting down with them, creating these leadership roles within the faculty, they're our biggest advocates. They will fall on the sword for us and protect us from anybody who gets angry, because we're there for them. So that's a lot about the culture of innovation. And I think Jude is going to move into some of the learning.
So my version of defensive calendaring is never having a meeting with Matt within 2 hours after his thinking sessions.
Yeah.
That's my role, way of doing this. So I sort of wanted to start wrapping up here a little bit, and then we'll go over to our chime-in calendar by sort of throwing something out that may be, let's say it's intentionally provocative. I think that we have languaging sometimes that the way that people learn is fundamentally changing, right? How many of you have heard that at some point in your life? The way people learn is nobody's raising their hand. Come on, somebody's heard that. I've heard that. I want to say that I don't think that's true, actually. I think that how people learn will change on an evolutionary timescale. Okay, like how we learn changes with evolution, and how we learn now is a result of hundreds of thousands of years of evolution. How people are motivated to thoughtful action is changing, but how people learn is not changing. And that subtle nuance has pretty profound implications for a lot of what we're talking about, I think. The reason I think that's relevant is because the pedagogical implications of saying how people learn is fundamentally changing sometimes leads us to
assume that all of this technology craziness that Matt and I have been talking about should be designed to drive bombard students with media. They're multimodal, you know, that's cognitive distraction. We know that there are limits to attention span. We know that there are cognitive limits to attention span, that cognitive presence we talked about. We know that to build expertise, how many hours does it take to build expertise in a complex subject? 10,000 hours. It takes 10,000 hours. That's not 10,000 hours of being bombarded with media. That's 10,000 hours of hard, thoughtful work. You are not going to learn to play piano by listening to somebody play piano as you sleep. It's just not going to happen, right? I mean, unless you're a prodigy. I mean, there are such things as prodigies. That's a different thing. But for most of us, the proletariat cognitive masses, we have to think hard about hard subjects for a long time, and we have to make a lot of mistakes, and we have to go through the painful and sometimes personally traumatizing experience of re-encoding bad information. That is hard stuff to do. We know how it works, or this is one version of how we're pretty sure it works, right? People have to code this stuff, and they have to chunk it. That's how we get from 10 minutes, curses. And so the point here is to say that part of our rationale for having a framework as we're running headlong into all of this craziness, because it's crazy for us too, is to have a guiding star. And part of that is that idea of balancing teaching presence, cognitive presence, and social presence with an understanding that how people learn is not fundamentally shifting. To get students to expertise, if that's our model, they have to think hard about hard subjects for a long time. They need remediation, they need support, they need feedback. And we have to challenge them to rethink their thinking. And bombarding them with media or giving them all of this is not necessarily going to get there if that's our goal. So ensuring that our efforts help students learn, I think that's, we're in higher education. That's why we're here, I think. That's why I'm here. We need to promote, not diminish, presence. Technology can really make us feel disconnected from other people, or thoughtfully designed, it can make us feel very connected to other people. Our guiding principles here are to make it feel connected. We want to help get learners thinking hard about subject matter as much as possible. We want to use technology to get them reinvested in those 10,000 hours of expertise. We need to encourage making connections between and among disciplines, finding ways to make, again, that connection across and among these different things. Provide opportunities for feedback and ensure the proper encoding that was represented in the last slide. And we really need to be championing what sort of the educational experience of using technology ought to be. It can't just be what can we do, it needs to be what should we do. And how can we use what we know about how people learn? One version of that is this social presence model, the piece that we showed, to make sure that we're doing this in a thoughtful way. That we're not just driving headlong into the next gadgetware. All right, so we will take your questions from the audience. I will pull up our second Chime In question, so I'll take the first question from Chime In to thank someone who asked here. So how do we encourage faculty to develop online learning communities when they've never participated in any online community? That's actually a really good question. There's a couple of quick responses I would have, although some of you are probably as smart or smarter about this than I am. One way to do it is to reduce the cognitive load for faculty to do this. So what I mean by that, technology needs to largely disappear to the faculty. It needs to solve problems for them. So if faculty believe and see that technology is creating, I mean, again, back to what we've been harping about, that it's creating a sense of presence, right? That my faculty don't want to do this because they're like, well, it's a less than experience, right? Teaching online, and I can't create community online. It can't be done. Creating easy access points for them to say, no, it can be done. You know, there are ways to do this. You can step into the flow of that community building very easily. Let me help you. Let me guide you. Let's show that this can work. Having faculty talking to faculty, I mean, it's trite, but it it works, having faculty explain this. I will say that I talked about the telepresence, the Cisco telepresence. I've been in educational technology at higher education for 20 years. I'm older than I look. I have never seen a technology that faculty understand as intuitively or are as willing to use as telepresence. And the reasons I believe is that the cognitive load is zero. It's easier than making a phone call. They push one button and they're instantly connected to people. And it is a distance learning model. It is a model of this. Now, can we do that all the time? No. But it is a model for how we can get people with skin in the game to say, hey, this is easy, and guess what? It really solves a problem for you. You can have presence. They get that. We can take one live, or do we have anybody? No.
We do. We have an online question, that was submitted a little bit earlier in the presentation.
Yes.
Can those that create guest accounts on the UOM system use ChimeIn too, and can we create courses?
The answer is yes. ChimeInCloud.com is a free online service brought to you by the good people of the state of Minnesota. So, and yes, you can create courses. You can download. You can have students log into the course. Basically, you send them a little. What do you say? Like a little access code, right? And you can do it that way, and then you can download and know who said what and put it into your LMS. It comes in like a standard CSV format. The other thing that you can do is we do have it on GitHub. So if you want to download it and integrate it with Shibboleth in your own environment, and you have, you know, somebody with the technical chops to do that, you're welcome to it. Just search for ChimeIn on GitHub, and the download is right there. Yep. Live questions.
Maybe not.
No one, please. Oh, I feel like I should run a mic to you.
Yeah, no,
something.
There's a
microphone. Oh, there's
right
one
there.
Right here.
Yep.
So, I'm curious about your homegrown analytics.
Yeah.
And what that does more than, say, using Google Analytics.
Oh, good question.
Okay.
Google Analytics. Maybe I haven't done my homework. But no, come back. So tell me, I had never thought of using Google Analytics. So how would that work?
Actually, Google has put together some MOOCs, if you're
uh-huh.
aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And my institution had Google come, show us their stuff, we're using it around MOOCs. And it's incredibly helpful, and it's there.
Yeah.
So.
And
I like your open source attitude.
Yeah.
I like that, but
some people are Apple fanboys. I'm a Google fanboy. So I hadn't thought of that. So shame on me. Don't go anywhere afterwards. Let's trade cards.
Okay.
And we can trade war stories and figure out maybe that would be a good model.
It's already there.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. All right. See, I'm learning from you. Thank you. Anyone live? Okay, let's look at something here. There's a lot of questions about online. Let's see what we've got there. How are you incorporating online courses into non-traditionally online programs like music and theater? Oh, that's an interesting question. I can speak more historically. I've been at a lot of different institutions. I've only been at Minnesota State for the last year and a half. When I was at USC up the road here, I did help them build an online program in their fine arts department. And pedagogically, the dominant model of instruction in an art program is, well, I think you would agree with me if you're in that space, is the crit, right? So you develop a piece, and you present the piece, and you talk about the piece, and you write a paper about the piece you've developed, and then, you know, it goes through a crit, like the people in the space talk about it, right? And say, well, this is how I think you were successful. This is where maybe the piece doesn't work or falls apart or, you know, whatever it is. Part of what we did there was we had to design an online environment where remote learners could participate in a live critique. And there are different kind of ways to do that. Part of what we're talking about at Minnesota State in the art history, in a sort of art history context, it's always more viscous than you can tell in these things, but is using telepresence to actually have scholars who can curate local collections. So we're in talks with a museum in rural China that has recently gotten access to an old
palace
space there, and they the people who own the space don't want the artifacts to leave, right? So part of what we're talking about is, well, maybe we can do a telepresence experience where we can send one scholar, because we can't send a whole class, there, set up a telepresence experience, curate within their context on their terms to be able to see these amazing artifacts from, I don't know, Ming Dynasty, I think it is, that they don't want to leave their space, but because of the telepresence experience, it'll be large enough. Now, you want your minds blown? Well, it blows my mind. What we're thinking about trying to do in that kind of a situation is to be able to set up a 3D camera and then have 3D printers at the remote locations. So if we can get a high enough resolution image of artifacts like this, we can actually print out a copy of the artifact at distributed locations where people could physically put their hands on it. Is that technology there? I don't know. Probably not quite yet. But that's the sort of direction that we're hoping to go. So we're trying to think very creatively. I have 0 minutes left, don't I? I have totally 0 minutes left. Well, just as a quick wrap up, there's a lot of questions here on Chime-In. We will answer every one of them in sort of blog format at the bottom of that page. So if we didn't get to your question here or didn't answer it satisfactorily, Matt's and my email will be linked from that page as well. So you can follow up and we'll have some great ideas emerge and we'll be better at what we do. Thank you all very much
for
coming today on the last day, and hopefully this was a nice way to end things up.
Yeah.
Namaste.